So it's already 8:31. So okay, so let us begin. Hello everyone. It is let's see, it's the 12th. I didn't even note. I looked at my calendar here. It's Columbus Day. Columbus doesn't get such good to play today in America. Okay, and this is the 20th class. This means that this is the 24th class. Well, that's actually, there's a 25th because we did the Kitnios one, but now we've been going 24 straight weeks. So that's 6 months. Let's hope that, well, we can continue. But the reason it started, of course, with the book was because we were really stuck at home. But we've done a lot and we have more great stuff today. Let me just respond to a few things here, a number of things. I don't know if I don't like to go more than 10 or at most 15 minutes before we move on, but many people wrote to me. For those who wanted to know where the Gemara speaks about Kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, that it means that that the Chazal can be uproot marriages. That's what it means. It's in the Tosos Kesubos Gimel Amud Aleph. For those who asked me, or one of you asked me, where does the Gemara, where's this drusha that women are not counted as witnesses? That I said, according to the Rambam, even a Beis Din that's less can do that. Well, you can find this on Shavuos. Masachat Shavuot 30a. You can see the drasha right there where the Gemara derives it, that it's men, not women. Comments from Eli. I think it's Eli or not Eli. Eli Turkel. I think it's also Turkel, not Turkel. Turkel, rabbi, mathematician. I'm sure there are people here who know him. Right. Just a couple of things he mentioned. First of all, he claims that I mentioned last class that I think the Rambam is like the most progressive of the medievals when it comes to women. Ironically, people don't realize that. He told me that Professor Grossman says Rashi is the most pro-woman or the Rishonim. Okay. In terms of God not knowing the future, he points out that Professor Aviezer, Nathan Aviezer, has an article about this whole thing. I actually cite that article in my book, Limits of Orthodox Theology. I refer to that. We saw last week about wearing earrings. You know, is that considered a wounding? Chavala, and I, Rav Lichtenstein's point, and I quote Rav Mazuz, who says he doesn't get it. Why it's even a question? Because we saw in Chumash that they did it, in the Navi. Eli says it's not a good proof because maybe they didn't make holes in their ears for the earrings. They were just clip-ons. I don't know. Do they have clip-ons in ancient days? I'm not sure. He quotes a number of other interesting things. We mentioned, Eli, about that witnesses, that Bate Dinim in Israel, do take women because you sign a form giving judges leeway to do pshara. I didn't mention that, but we said that. He mentions that there's some rabbis who don't want women do with B'dikas Chametz because they think they're lazy. That's an example, I guess, of this of these negative views. But the real issue I want to mention is I said something, and he's a mathematician, so I can't challenge this. I don't know if we have any other mathematicians. I said that in most shuls, you have more Kohanim than Levim. And there should be many more Levim than Kohanim, because the Levi, it's one tribe, it's a tribe, and Kohen, it's just a family. And he even points out that in the desert, there were a ratio of about 6,000 to 1. Kohanim to Levim. But he says as follows, that I'm incorrect, because the census of the Jews in the desert has little correlation with the number of children, etc. Over thousands of years, the influence of the initial distribution is negligible. See chaos theory. Well, being that I know nothing about chaos theory, I wrote back to him, and he explained it all about how over time that these initial, just because you start with a large group, it doesn't mean it remains a large group, as well as he acknowledges what I said, that Kohanim kept their yichus. Even on tombstones, we see that Levim didn't. But certain systems, a tiny change at the beginning can have a huge effect, and et cetera, et cetera. So any mathematicians, you can explore it if you want with Eli about chaos theory and how, at least my Balabatish understanding that just because thousands of years ago you have many, many more Levim, it doesn't mean anything. One of you asked, I said that in Gerba they go to school on Shabbos. How do you go to school on Shabbos? Well, why can't you go to school on Shabbos? That they don't write. After lunch, they all return back to the yeshiva. And the boys go to school. The girls have like groups. They go back to the so they learn for the next few hours. We can't do that because we don't live within walking distance. But if everything's within walking distance, you know, learning Torah doesn't take a vacation on Shabbos. You don't need to sleep if you're a young person. Two more things. Reb Arye in Israel wanted to, I said as follows, and this language you find elsewhere as well, that I said that Reb Chaim was not makpid, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, on tefillah b'tzibur. What he said tells me is that there's this book, I have it over there, about Reb Meir Soloveitchik. Two volumes, Reb Meir Soloveitchik, that's the Brisker Rav's son. It's basically discussions he had, all sorts of interesting stuff, including in there, Meir Soloveitchik says that we all know that the Rav, J.B. Soloveitchik, is greater than all of us. Just too bad he had the wrong hashkafas. But they acknowledge that in terms of learning that the Rav was greater than all of them. But in this book, he writes that someone said this actually to the Brisker Rav, that Reb Chaim was not makpid on Tefillah B'Tzibur. When I say not makpid, that means he didn't feel he needed to go daven with a minyan if he's somewhere. Kriyas HaTorah, yes. And in the book, Reb Meir replies that this is the wrong way to put it. Reb Chaim was makpid on everything. If he didn't daven B'Tzibur, it's because he's makpid on something else. So you need to stress that. It's not, and I didn't mean that in the sense that, in any event, I didn't mean that he just didn't think, wasn't serious about it. Maybe he thought that at that time he's in a sugya, it's not as important, or he could have more kavana. I already quoted a couple of weeks ago that the Chazon Ish tells someone, Erev Shabbos, he recommends to him not to daven mincha with the minyan. He's talking about a situation where they would daven, let's say, earlier in the day, because he says for his kavana, so it's not that there, you could say, it's not that he's not makpid on the minyan, it's that he's makpid on kavana. It's like the old thing, Reb Chaim, the famous story, it's that we've told so many times, it's not when he told people to eat on Yom Kippur, it's not that he's not makpid on Yom Kippur, it's that he's more makpid on Pikuach Nefesh. Okay, we got a couple more seconds here. I'll get to maybe only one of these, but if I get to two, we're lucky. I still told you about Amori. But I need to reply again, because sometimes you ask the questions, and I'm a rego achas. So Baruch asked the question last week about Vayehi. And you all listened, if you listened to Kriyas HaTorah, this morning also, but if you listen to Kriyas HaTorah over Yontif, yesterday, you would have heard it, you'll hear it next Shabbos. Baruch asked me, how is it pronounced? So I want to, you know, I gave you an explanation, but just let me say 2 more minutes about this, and that way you can, in shul, you can have something to tell your neighbor if you go to shul outdoors. I want to show, first I want to pull up so you can see now let me pull up here. Here is the laning. Well, first of all, we know Kiddush. Some people start Kiddush, Vayer Vayevoker. So that's also something to pay attention to. Here's a mistake a lot of people make in Kiddush. First of all, it begins, it's not Vayechulu, it's Vayechulu. But in this word, some people say Vayvarech Elohim es Yom HaShavi'i. It's not Vayvarech, it's Vayvarech. And it's not Vayavarech, it's Vayvarech. Okay, but that's not what I'm concerned with. I'm interested in this word. You could see, I just want to see if you see my cursor here. Ah, yes, okay. So you see my cursor on the words Vayera Vayvoker. The word vayehi is written two different ways in the Torah, in Tanakh. Sometimes it's written just by itself without that line, that hyphen, the makef, in which case it doesn't have that little line next to the vav. So everyone pronounces it vayehi. That there's no question. What do you do in a case like this when you have that little line there? How do you pronounce it? Is it vayehi vayevoker? Or is it, like some of you might say, each one of you yourself, if you say it's a Kiddush, you have to think about what you say. Do you say vayihi erev vayivoker, or is it vayihi erev vayivoker? So here is, I want you to pay attention to Rabbi Weider.
Oh, es kol yerek esev lochlo vayihi chayin, vayyar Elohim es kol asher osov, hinne tov, meod vayihi erev vayivoker yom hashishi.
So he clearly says, Vayehi erev, vayehi voker. He makes it a shva na. He doesn't read it vayehi erev, vayehi voker. Okay, now you know from last week that my admiration for Rabbi Weider's ability is, bar none. I think he's the best, but I have to say that I disagree with him here, and let me explain to you why I disagree with him. if you open up, for instance, first that line there, what is that line? That line is what we call the metta or agaya. That is supposed to tell you, for example, either secondary stress on a word, or sometimes it's used for vowel length. If you open up my favorite book, book I used to teach, Biblical Hebrew, you can see it here. You can see here, Practical Grammar for Classical Hebrew by Weingreen. If you look in this book, if you want to learn Biblical Hebrew, this is the best. If you look on page 9, and if you look again on page 18, he tells you that you pronounce this Vayehi. And that's the whole point of the Gaia there, the metic. And as far as I know, this is what is found in the academic literature. But I have to say that we don't follow the academic literature. And maybe this is how it's supposed to be years ago, but we follow a tradition of Masorah. And if you look at all the tikkunim that distinguish us, you look at Ish Matzliach, you look at Simanim, you look at the art scroll, Siddur, they all leave this as Shvanach. Secondly, if you look in the Mincha Shai, I'm holding it right here, he says explicitly that although this is in, if you look in the Nosafos of Mincha Shai, it's a nice new edition, page 102 to 103, he says that although the Gaia often does lead to a Shvana afterwards, like we saw in Ritzafah, he specifically says that in the case, and he gives this example even of Vaihi, it does not. I'll read you the exact language here. Find it here. He deals with all sorts of other interesting things, unusual things like Halviim. But if it has ima patach kamo vayihi vayichi, he says that in such a case it's a shvanach. And so therefore I believe. But if anyone knows Rabbi Weider, or if I'm missing something, if there's another Masorite who thinks differently, but I looked and I couldn't find everyone. As far as I can tell, all the traditional sources say that this word should be vahi erev, vahi voker. Not despite, even though there is a Gaia there, it's an exception, and it's not vahi erev, vahi voker. It's not the biggest deal. It's not like Ritzafat, which changes the meaning. It's not like another word that has the Gaia there. We say it in Davening, but it's in Kriyas HaTorah. Vayirahu am es Adonai vayaminu b'Adonai v'Moshe avdo. If you pronounce that vayiru, where it's a shanach, you need to correct the Baal Koreh there, because that means they saw, not that they feared. And you'll notice there's two yuds, and there's also the Gaia there. So there it makes a difference. Here it doesn't. Okay, we're going to have to, we're going to hold off. Next week, we'll be back to Amori. I want to show you something interesting. Remind you of the Dean Martin song, too. But Shimon Steinmetz, who called my attention to this, I'll get to I saw something he wrote about this. We'll get to this next week, as well as what the Zohar says about it. But I want to pick up now in the book, we are up to, Simon, we're starting a new section here. It's called Darchei Psikat Halacha, not Darkei. That's, since we're talking grammar, I think the very first class we had 20 weeks ago, I pointed that out. It's not Darkei, it's not Darkei Shalom, it's Darchei. Darchei, ways of deciding halacha. And we're on page 189, Simon Pebe's 82. And the first couple ones here connect to something we had before. The first person who's answering question here, everyone should know who he is today, because he's very important. That's Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, the Rishon LeZion, succeeded. His father. His father was Rishon Lezion Ravad Yosef, and he is now the Rishon Lezion. And for those who are interested and find important the whole issue of Corona, he's been very strong on this. In general, the Sephardic rabbis have all been strong on this. It's saying not to go into synagogues, to only daven outside, and that's Rav Yitzhak Yosef. Rav Yitzhak Yosef is obviously the follower of his father, the Ravad Yosef, the whole idea that all Sfardim and Eretz Yisrael, at least Sfardim, we'll see about Ashkenazim perhaps, have to follow the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch. get to the questions, Susanna and the rest. I'll get to you at the end. I asked him a question, a simple question, because the Rav Avad Yosef insists that the Yemenites need to follow the Shulchan Aruch. That is, they have a tradition in areas where they don't follow the Shulchan Aruch. They have their own approach. They follow the Rambam. The Moroccans. Moroccans have many examples where they don't follow the Shulchan Aruch. Why do the Yemenites need to follow the Shulchan Aruch? The Yemenites are not Sephardim. The Yemenites are as Sephardic as the Italians are, as the Germans are. I mean, what do they have to do with Sephardic Jews? And the Moroccans, for that matter, the Moroccans are Sephardic. In fact, the Moroccans are more Sephardic than the Iraqis, the ones from Bavel, because you actually have Spanish Jews in Morocco. They became, that's what Sfarad means. But why do they need to follow the Shulchan Aruch? Just because they come to the land of Israel. If they came as individuals, first of all, let's start with this assumption that Chacham Avad Yosef has, which no one before him has ever said. That's what makes it so radical, that every single person living in the land of Israel has to follow the Shulchan Aruch. No one has ever said that. Even the Shulchan Aruch didn't say that, because it said if you had other minhagim that it predated what he wrote, you can keep them. But then you did have many people, though, who said that they had to adopt the minhag of Eretz Yisrael, which was basically Shulchan Aruch, but not entirely. Rabbi Shlush, the late Rabbi Shlush from Netanya, has a whole kuntras against Rav Avadya on this. But let's go with what Rav Avadya says. If you come as an entire community, if you come together as a group, you know, if you come as an individual, then you have to follow the practices of the local customs and practices of the community. But we know the Moroccans came as a group. They came from around 54 and for the next 10 years. So they didn't come individually. The Yemenites also came with significant numbers. They had their own Bat Beitin already in the 1920s. So why should they have to follow that? That's my question. And he says as follows. This is the Rishon Lezion Yitzhak Yosef. He says that there's a responsum of the Shulchan Aruch who says that when you come into a community, even if you have different practices, you have to accept the practices of that community. However, the Pani Meiros, whose kever we saw, he was the Rav of Meir of Eisenstadt, he didn't hold that. He held that you could still keep your practices as an Ashkenazi. He says, if you're an Ashkenazi, you go where the Sephardim are, you don't have to accept it. And Chacham Avadia says, the Sephardim accepted this tshuva. In other words, the Sephardim accepted where Yosef Karo said that if you come as individuals, therefore you need to accept the Shulchan Aruch. The Ashkenazim did it. But that doesn't change my question. He doesn't answer my question. That the Moroccans came as an entire group and the Yemenites came. And that's why the Moroccans don't accept Chacham Avad Yosef in this. The Syrians did and others did, but the Moroccans refused to and the Yemenites refused to. And he doesn't really, we'll see, his brother tries to answer it better. But he doesn't really answer the question. He simply says that Sephardim, since the Sephardim all accepted the Shulchan Aruch's ruling, but the Shulchan Aruch's ruling is dealing with individuals who come, not with, he ends it, he says, if anyone who does the Shulchan Aruch, you're doing like, he says, Osek 200 Rabbanim. What does that mean, Osek 200 Rabbanim? What it means is, there's this tradition that 200 rabbis gave their approval to the Shulchan Aruch, that this should be what binds us. But, it's a difficult, he hasn't really answered the question, why an entire community? He has answered why Ashkenazi wouldn't have to. Everyone wonders, why do Ashkenazi go to Israel? He and his father have never insisted that they become Sephardim. But he hasn't really, so that we understand. But as far as I can see, in this response, in number 82, he only answers why individuals, and that was the practice. Generally, if you came from Morocco, if you came from Yemen, let's say you came in the 18th century, the 19th century, you would be absorbed in the local community. And you wouldn't keep a private practice that you had. Now, the same question I asked, and that's Simon Pei Gimel, to his brother, Rav Avraham Yosef. Here he is. Who was chief rabbi of Cholon. We dealt with him as well. And he goes into a little more detail, but I don't think he's right historically. I said, what's the difference? Why do the Sephardim, you say the Sephardim have to accept it and the Ashkenazim don't? He says the Ashkenazim, when they first came to the land of Israel, They did everything like the Sfardim. He says the Ashkenazi who first came to Israel, they did everything like the Sfardim until there was a mass immigration of Ashkenazi when they created a Beit Din for Ashkenazi. But this is not true historically. This is not true at all. The Ashkenazim have been coming to the land of Israel really since medieval times. So if you deal with one person, it's one thing. But when they came as families, as small groups, they did not follow the Sephardic approach. And he says, when they came with a mass immigration, they set up a Beit Din Shalkol Mikot Ashkenazim, which he calls the Beit Din of the Eda Haredi. Now that is the Beit Din in the 19th century. It's true that in the 19th century, the Ashkenazim set up a Beit Din for Ashkenazim. However, they were not following Sephardic practices before. The followers of the Vilna Gaon, the followers of the early Hasidim, they weren't following Sephardic practices. They had Ashkenazic practices. Furthermore, he's incorrect to say that this Beit Din, this 19th century Beit Din, which, for instance, Rav Shmuel Salant was the head of it for many years, he says that this is the Eda Haredit. This isn't the Eda Haredit. Or I should say, the Eda Haredit says it's their Beit Din. But who says they're right? The question is, what's the continuation? Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was on this Beit Din, he claims that it's not the Eda Haredit, that the continuation of Rav Shmuel Salant's Beit Din is what became the Rabbanut's Beit Din. Because Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was on the Beit Din, he continued to be on the Beit Din. This Beit Din was absorbed into the state of Israel. So this and the Eda Haredi is a separatist organization that was created separate. So, look, they will say that we're the real continuation. But I don't think historically that's correct either. Because none of the people who were on the Beit Din from Rav Shmuel Salant were in the Eda Haredi. They all remained in the regular Beit Din. It raises the interesting question, though, who's the true historic community? Shimshon Raphael Hirsch always claimed that, even though he's a separatist community, that we are the continuation of old Frankfurt. So, for example, you look at the great Rabbonim of Frankfurt. You have, the Rav Pinchas Horowitz and all the Gedolim. If you go to the cemetery, you see the great rabbis who were in Frankfurt. We are the continuation. Why? Because we're continuing traditional Judaism. The fact that the reformers took over and now there's an Orthodox segment to the larger community, they're not the continuation. So that was Hirsch's perspective, but it doesn't really apply here. Okay, so that answers the first thing. Then he says, and he says that the Ashkenazim always regarded himself as a separate kehila. And he says there were two separate Batei Din. There was Ashkenazi and the Sephardic, so there's no prohibition of what we call losi skodajim, don't separate. And also he says that these Ashkenazim, they never accepted the Shulchan Aruch to begin with, because in Chutz La'aretz, they followed Rav Moshe Isserles. So you're going to say when they come to Israel, they have to all of a sudden follow the Shulchan Aruch? No, they continue following Rav Moshe Isserles. But what about my question about the Yemenites and others? He says as follows. V'umatam baruch rov hatemanim. So it's a malitza here from Kedusha. In Dalit, you say, umasam baruch yomeru. So he says, opposite them, umasam rov hatemanim, he says, and all the Moroccans and those from Iraq, they accepted the law, the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch in their lands. Okay, that is basically correct. It's true that most of the Yemenites, not just the Shami, which he says, even the Baladi, they accepted to a certain extent. I don't know why he says that most of the Yemenites are Shami. I think it's probably 50-50. And it's true, the Moroccans and the Iraqis did accept the Shulchan Aruch, except for when they didn't accept it. So for instance, in Morocco, we just finished Sukkot. Did your wives, if you have any Sfardim here, this is one area where Chacham Avad Yosef was very influential. For instance, in the Syrian community, women always made a bracha on the lulav. Chacham Avad Yosef was able to change that. I heard this from Rabbi Shama. However, in Morocco, they also made a bracha on the lulav. And in Bavel, they also made a bracha on lulav. And in at least the Moroccans still continue to make the blessing on the lulav, as far as I know. And I know for a fact that many, I know it because you have the people of Mordechai Eliyahu's followers and others, or I should say Rav Yaakov, the people from the Kafachayim's family, they write about how they do not accept Chacham Avad Yosei. They make the bracha, their women make the bracha on the lulav. So though it's true that in general, the people in Iraq and Morocco accepted Shulchan Aruch, but in many areas, they didn't accept the Shulchan Aruch. In Bavel, for instance, women would make, they do like the Ashkenazim, they light the Shabbos candles and then make the bracha. So why should they, when they come to Israel, the Moroccans come as a whole community, hundreds of thousands, why should they give up their practices? He says that when they first started coming to Eretz Yisrael, they came as individuals, and therefore they were bottled to the larger group. Okay, and he said they didn't establish a Beit Din immediately on their own. I would agree then, and I think they would agree that those Moroccans who came, and they're always Moroccans, Moroccans always loved Eretz Yisrael. They were coming in the 19th century, even before that, they were coming to Eretz Yisrael. So they come to Eretz Yisrael, they join a Sephardic community, they adopt the Shulchan Aruch's rules. But when they started coming in the 50s, they were coming as huge communities. So Rav Shalom Messas, who we've mentioned, and I think we'll come back to him with one more time, his attitude always was, we came here as a group. When Morocco basically, it became too difficult to live in Morocco when it became independent, we came as a group, and therefore we continue with our practices. Just like we did it in Casablanca, we continue here. So the fact that, which is true, that they didn't set up their own Batei Din, they don't set up their own Shechita, he says, I don't see why that's relevant. It's not a question, I don't see why. Rav Shalom Messas and all these other great rabbis say it's not relevant. The fact that we didn't set up our own Beit Din for Shechita, we come with a group, we have our own shuls, Tunisia. They have their own shuls, and therefore we continue doing the same practices we did in where we were. In many places, the practices changed, but not because the Moroccans or the Tunisians gave in. It's because the kids started being educated in the Shah school system. So the young people came home, and they started pressuring the older people, and the older people either gave up, you know, changed them in hugging. So for instance, I'll give you another example. And this one has nothing to do with the Shulchan Aruch. It's not in the Shulchan Aruch. Chacham Avad Yosef was very stringent on this, based on the responsum of the Rambam that only became known, that was only published early in 1934, although it's mentioned in Maram Alashkar's Shuvot, that you can't stand for the Aseres HaDibros. Everyone in Morocco stood for the Aseres HaDibros. Everyone in Iraq stood for the Aseres HaDibros when you read it, and also on Shavuos. But if you're teaching, and they were teaching all the kids in the Shah school system not to do this, they're going to come home and they're going to say, it's not right. Chacham Avad says not to. So now you go to these shuls, people won't stand, or they'll stand from the beginning of the Aliyah. That's how these things change. Because you get the young generation, and then Chaim Soloveitchik, he introduced us to this word that people like to use, this fancy word to show they're educated without even realizing perhaps where it comes from, mimetic, from the word mimesis, that the mimetic tradition of Morocco is being pushed out, and of Yemen, all these places, because you have the Yalkut Yosef. The Yalkut Yosef is the new Shulchan Aruch that all the Sephardim use. It's a great work. From Yitzhak Yosef, 20-some volumes, but that's become the standard work now, and that's just like the Mishnah Berurah. We're going to see today, maybe, about how the Mishnah Berurah was so influential, and the Sephardic word, the Yalkut Yosef, was so influential, and it's basically been normalizing the practices of Rav Avad Yosef, making him normative, I should say. So that's, and he acknowledges in the last paragraph, if a Kehila Shlema, of Rabbi Neva Dayanev, a whole community of rabbis and Dayanim came to Eretz Yisrael and immediately set up for themselves a format which kept their practices in Chutz La'aretz, then they can continue doing what they're doing. But that's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they did for Morocco and Tunisia and other places. So the very next tshuva, just a tiny one, number 84, this really relates to something we had earlier, but we separated it because it really flows from here. But we spoke about it already. I asked Rav Yitzhak Yosef, why can't an Ashkenazi then eat kitnios? And he explains that the Ashkenazim never accepted this idea that they are absorbed into the Sephardim. And therefore, they're not, even though Rav Avraham Yosef disagrees. We saw this already. So that's just, we have here in the three tshuvot we saw, if you don't find it convincing, you're not alone, because the leading Sephardic rabbis are Mordechai Eliyahu, and Rav Sholem Misas, and many other leading Sephardic rabbis never got behind Rav Avad Yosef's attempt to make normative his understanding. And it led to a lot of disputes. It led to, in the early years, Chacham Avad Yosef dealt with a lot of tzaras. In fact, his earliest work was burnt by the Iraqi sages. It was burnt by Iraqi scholars of sorts, because they thought he was being disrespectful to the Ben Ish Chai, because here he comes, he's a young person, like 20 years old, saying that now that we're in Eretz Yisrael, we don't need to follow the Ben Ish Chai. For the Iraqi Jews, the Ben Ish Chai was absolute. You don't not follow the Ben Ish Chai just because you're in Israel. So these, I think these letters are of interest. I asked them because I don't know really where they ever explained this issue, and I'm not really convinced. And Rabbi Zinni, who I mentioned from the Technion two classes ago, he has a long piece about saying, do you make a bracha on Rosh Chodesh? A challah for Rosh Chodesh, because Chacham Avad Yosef says no. And he has about 80 pages there, which he really takes apart Rav Avad Yosef's whole approach that the North Africans need to immediately reject their traditions. If it happens over time, it happens over time. But the idea that there's something wrong with it. So that this is an important issue. If you, especially if you live in Israel, you might be aware of this, the idea of the Sephardic normativity, which is what Chacham Avad Yosef was battling for 40 years. His sons still believe it, but they don't really push it the same way he did. Now we move on to number 85. Getting back to this great rabbi who I believe is, as I said, the leading scholar of the Yemenites, Rav Ratzabi, Yitzhak Ratzabi. Here's what I think is a very interesting tshuva, which I never saw explained in any sefer. And he helps explain it, but it's like we used to say in yeshiva that about Tosfos sometimes, the questions are better than the answers. And I still think the question is better than the answer, because the answer still leaves. But you all have something to contribute, I think, to this. Well, here's my question. Well, first let me tell you why I had this question. I had an actual experience I had that I was at a shir. I don't even remember. I guess it was in Boston. This responsum, it goes back to the 1990. It doesn't have a date on it. It was like 1990. And we were learning. I don't remember what he was giving between Mincha Ma'ariv. He could have been doing for Chayyadim or Mishnah Berurah, whatever the Sefer was, it's not important. But after quoting what the Sefer said, the rabbi said, but we don't hold like that. The rabbi told us, despite the fact that we're reading the Sefer, we don't hold like that. In other words, I don't even remember whether we're more machmir or more meiko, whatever. He said, we don't hold like it. So I asked the rabbi later, I said to him, here we're learning the Sefer. Let's say it's Chayyadim for sake of argument, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And we read it, and he told us we could do this on Shabbos. And you said, but we don't hold of it. So I asked, well, how is the person who's learning the Sefer supposed to know that we, in quotation marks, don't hold of it? He's sitting home every Shabbos, he's learning the Chayyadim. How is he supposed to know we don't hold of it? So the rabbi said to me, he replied, that's why you need to have a rov. That's what he said. So you can, point being, so you can ask. But the whole thing made no sense to me at the time. It doesn't make sense. What does that mean, Rav? Every single thing I read in the Chayyadim, I'm supposed to ask my local rabbi, do we hold of this? And what does that mean, do we hold of it? Basically, I'm asking, does he hold of it? And why should I listen to him over the Chayyadim? And he's going to say, well, because his rabbi told him. But why isn't the Chayyadim good enough? And quite apart from that, you can't do it in practice. Well, every single halacha you learn, you have to call up the rabbi on the phone and say, well, I just learned this siman. Do we hold of this? I mean, it's undoable. And no one in history ever said that there's such a concept that you got to ask about every single thing. I started wondering, though, does this mean, no? So fine, what this rabbi told me made no sense. But does this mean that you can take any sefer? I could take, when I was in high school, we all learned the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. We divided it and we went through it and had a few different grades. So you and other grades, at least one grade we did. Another grade we did the Chayyadim. Later, I guess you do the Mishnah Berurah. So can I take the Kitzur? Can I take the Mishnah Berurah? Can I take the Aruch HaShulchan? Can I take the Chayyadim? And I learned that I make a Seder and what it says I do. Or do I have to always be worrying about that I'm doing something wrong because we, whoever we is, don't hold to that? So that's the question I asked him. If you have a dispute between the Acharonim, like you see this is a dispute between the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan. Do I need to ask a posek what to do? Or can I say, well, Avid Kamara, Avid Kamara, Kamara Avid, that either whatever you do, you're right. Whatever you do, you're wrong. It doesn't really matter. You can take whatever way you want because they're both great rabbis. Or do I have to ask? Who would you ask? Then you have to find a big posek to ask to decide it. And I wasn't asking about like a big thing, like, one of these major issues we're speaking about, just any issue, you know, how to make tea on Shabbos or something. And then I said, this is an important question because there's many people who learn Mishnah Berurah, Chayadim, etc., and they don't know if they can rely on what they're learning because maybe we don't paskin like this. That's what the rabbi told me. He said, you can't just learn the Chayadim and the Mishnah Berurah because you don't know. Maybe we don't hold like him. I'll tell you something else. That you can't even rely on the Mishnah Berurah because maybe the Mishnah Berurah didn't hold like that. What do I mean by that? Well, I just was learning over Shabbos, the Sefer points out from Rav Ruderman that he was with the Chafetz Chaim when he was young and the Chafetz Chaim was eating dessert and he didn't make a bracha on the dessert. And Rav Ruderman asked the Chafetz Chaim, I don't understand. In the Mishnah Berurah, you say that you're supposed to make a bracha on dessert. And he quotes the Chafetz Chaim as saying, yes, that's what I wrote that's what I thought when I wrote it. But now that I see that people eat dessert, it's part of the meal, not extra. And therefore, I no longer hold that way. When I was in yeshiva, they told us that for fruit. And to this day, I make ha'etz on fruit because it's not really part of the meal. But here I just saw over Yontif that the Chafetz Chaim retracted this and said that, no, now that you eat it as part of the meal, it's not like something separate. The one bracha includes it all. So that raises the question, do we rely on Rav Ruderman? Do we have to, what do we do in a case like that? But, here you have the Engel Dover Sof, and I think most people would say you can rely on the Chafetz Chaim because even if he changed his mind, the Shita still has value. Even if he nevertheless didn't hold it in the end, the fact is that it has a good basis. So I ask him, in short, can I take a single book, like the Mishnah Berurah Chayadim, and follow it, just follow everything he says? And if not, well, what's the proper way to learn halacha? How am I supposed to learn halacha if you tell me that I can't rely on it? So let's see how he answers this. Then wait till you see what he says about the Aruch HaShulchan. It's going to get some of you very upset. The mimetic people are going to be very upset what he says about Shulchan Aruch. He says as follows, and I don't know if everyone would agree with what he says, even though he doesn't really answer the question as much as I wanted, because he sort of is speaking about the rabbis, the posek, but not so much about individuals later on, but I think it applies. So he says as follows. He begins, in the case you're describing, when there's machlokes among the achronim, ein halacha mukhrat mukhrat. He says, there's no absolute decision. We don't have a Shulchan Aruch, we don't have a Gemara. You can't tell me that if the Aruch HaShulchan, or say Mishnah Berurah disagrees with the Chai Adam or the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, that one position is out of the fold now. We can't. It's like no one would say today that you can pick up just some medieval. We have a lot of these medieval codes. Pick up, for example, the Iter or something, or the Mordechai, and just read that and say, well, this is I'm going to follow. No, because we have the Shulchan Aruch. We have a whole tradition. But what he explains is that we don't have anything after the Shulchan Aruch. Although he's going to apparently, he might backtrack a little later. He's going to try to say that the Mishnah Berurah, at least for Ashkenazi, might be that new era, I guess you could say. But in general, no one's going to say you can pick up just a medieval code and just read it. You can't even pick up the Rambam and learn like that. But he's saying for Achronim, recent post-game, he says that's absolutely permissible because we don't have he quotes the Gemara I said, Ovid Kamar, Ovid Kamar. There's no, we don't have an absolute decision in any sense. And this applies to lay people as well. So you don't need to ask a rabbi. You see the chafetz, you see the chayyadim, it says, and you can rely on it. What he says, and which is true, is, you know, if you live in the Orthodox community, over time you learn that certain leniencies are not generally accepted or certain stringencies are not accepted, and you'll learn, you know, what is basically done. But the idea that you can rely on what you read in a standard text, He says it's absolutely permissible, and there's no obligation to, because you're reading the Sefer. And he says, oh, well, you don't even need a chapes alayim b'shar esfarim. You don't need to look at any other books. You see something that's a little strange in the chayyadah, maybe too, a little leniency. You don't need to look in other books to see. You can rely on it 100%. Then he says, of course, it's best that you pick the Sefer you learn from that are the most accepted and mefursamim that and famous that have spread in Israel. So he says that any Sefer, like that's halacha Sefer, which is an reliable Sefer you can use, but it's better to take the accepted ones. There's a lot of books, halacha books that were published. There's a lot of books, for instance, on Hilchos Shabbos. People don't know about them anymore because Shmir Shabbos Kolchasa pushed them out. There's the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. There's updated versions of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. There was a Rabbi Feldman who did one. There's others. There's all sorts of halacha works. And he could take any of those are fine, he says. For the religious Zionists now, well, just like Yalkut Yosef for the Sfardim is the new Shulchan Aruch, this work by Rabbi Eliezer Malam, Panine Halacha, is becoming the standard work. They've printed like a million of them. They're studied in all the schools. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch used to be the most popular book, but who reads the Kitzur anymore? We have the updated ones. So he said, and by the way, we have this for all areas. You want to know Avelos, so they have the books on Avelos there. Muktzah, you have books on Muktzah. So, but you have, there's a, probably 15 books on Muktzah you could learn. And he says they're all, you can rely on all of them, assuming they're acceptable story. But it's better not to take some book that no one knows about, even if the rabbi was a big scholar. He says, use the works that are accepted. And what are the ones? Aruch HaShulchan, which I mentioned, he says. Oh, then he says, but to be said to Russia, he says, Aruch HaShulchan, which I mentioned, he says, I heard from some Gedolim, you don't rely on the Aruch HaShulchan. We'll see my response to this. So when he says, it's incredible, though, well, he's Yemenite, okay, but still he studied in Kol Torah. He says, pick the Sfarim that are the most accepted and famous. And as for the Aruch HaShulchan, because I said in my letter, can you take any book you want? Like, let's say there's a dispute to Mishnah Aruch HaShulchan, he says, don't take the Aruch HaShulchan, because I've heard from Gedolim not to rely on the Aruch HaShulchan. I was shocked when I heard that, because as we mentioned before, Rabbi Henkin, and I mentioned this in my classes, Rav Henkin says that if it's a dispute between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, you go like the Aruch HaShulchan for a variety of reasons. First of all, he's later. He quotes the Mishnah Berurah, but the second of all, he's a community rabbi. The Mishnah Berurah is not a community rabbi, so it's a Maisa. And they gave all sorts of reasons why. And I made this public that I in my classes, a big student, and I wrote about it. And then a grandson of Moshe Feinstein wrote to me that he heard personally from Moshe Feinstein the exact same thing, that in a dispute between the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan, we go like the Aruch HaShulchan. And it's known that Rav Soloveitchik also held the same thing, that the Aruch HaShulchan, they held in Lita, they held very much of the Aruch HaShulchan, not over the Mishnah Berurah. We're going to see what he says when I say that in a minute, but he says, no, it's true, the Aruch HaShulchan is a Sefer Nifla. It's a wondrous book, and the author is a Gavra Rabba. He's a great man. He says, but there's Dvorim Mechudashim. There's all sorts of new ideas in the Aruch HaShulchan, and his proofs are not always sufficient. One of the things about the Aruch HaShulchan, and it's mentioned in the classic Soloveitchik article on Mimetic Society, Rupture and Reconstruction, is that the Aruch HaShulchan in many ways sees himself as justifying the oral, the community tradition in the face of the written tradition. So you find a lot of limud schus there. But he says to look the Chazon Ish and Shar Mitzuyan B'Halacha, that was an old, very nice work on from like the 50s and the 60s, I should say, on the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch by Rabbi Brown, that they point out a difficulty in the Aruch HaShulchan, but I don't see why that's a big deal. You could point out a difficulty in every source. But you see Rabbi Ratzabi downgrading the Aruch HaShulchan. Among the books, he doesn't want you going by the Aruch HaShulchan, even though technically you can. It's a reliable work, but he says you shouldn't. So what does he say? Mishnah Berurah, Chayei Adam, Shtilei Zeitim, that's a Yemenite work of Halacha, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Ben Ish Chai, Kaf HaChai, and the standard ones. He says, you can do like them. Kozman, as long as you don't know that, the Olam doesn't, the general practice is not like them, you can follow them. So you can make a Seder to study these works. And then later, 5 years from now, you'll learn that really, despite what the Ben Ishlai says, we don't hold like him. The Minhag is not like then. That's okay. I report, that was his tshuva. Originally, although this was published in his volume, Olat Yitzchak, it originally was two separate letters. So I wrote back to him with a different question as well as adding on. I said, well, are you then allowed to take, because he said that all these books are reliable. Can I take heterim from all, can I look, you know, I go to the Mishnah Berurah, he has a heter here, and then the Chayyadim, he has a leniency there. Can I take all these leniencies and say, well, since they're said by reliable great rabbis, I can follow them, because as long as they don't contradict. We'll see, the Gemara says that you're a Rasha if you take leniencies from this and from that, but it's clear in the Gemara it means if they contradict each other. So can I look in all the different Sfarim, and in many cases you can always find a leniency. Is that okay, first of all? And I say, for example, can I take a heter on Hilchos Shabbos from the Mishnah Berurah and another heter on Hilchos Sukkah from the Chayei Adam when they have nothing to do with one another? And also about chumros. Some people like to do chumros. Later on, Ratzavi says, you know, people, if they have nerves, problems of nerves, they like to take all the different chumros. Can I take chumros from different Sfarim? Or must you take one sefer? Take a sefer, Chayei Adam, a Mishnah Berurah, and follow it consistently. And if not, well, then what's the proper path? That's my first question. You hear a lot about I have to follow every, it was all the safer consistently, but none of us do. Even the people, people who ask, certain posting, they ask for Schechter and everything, but I haven't met any individual who doesn't not drink milk or something, and there are Schechter or certain chumras that people don't follow. And what does that mean? We all eat from the OU, and we're relying on Rav Schechter. Does that mean we're bound to everything he says? And Rabbi Belsky. And you have all plenty. Ramosha Feinstein's own family. I know this for a fact because I spoke to one of his descendants. They themselves used liquid soap on Shabbos. Maybe they use time clocks also. When Ramosha says you can't. So I don't. Where do you draw the line on this? That's my first question. And then I get to the Aruch HaShulchan because this bothered me a lot. And I said that. I find it quite strange that you wrote that you heard from Gedolim not to rely on the Aruch HaShulchan. Who's greater than the Aruch HaShulchan? Even when I was in yeshiva in the 80s, I know Rav Lichtenstein at BMT told the guys from Gruss to use the Aruch HaShulchan. I said, and I was wrong, but I said, it's almost certain to me that this Shmua, that what you heard, he said he heard, in him personally, he heard in the opinion of certain Gedolim not to rely on the Aruch HaShulchan, you must have heard from the Hungarian poskim. Because the Hungarians never accepted the Aruch HaShulchan, they never accepted Rosh Shom Shvadron, the Marsham, the Hungarians didn't accept him. I said, because the Hungarians never accepted the Aruch HaShulchan, because he was lenient in many areas. And many of the Hungarian poskims were stringent. And I said, and many reasons, the reason they were stringent is they're fighting against the reformers, which didn't have in Lithuania. And I say to him, you cannot say this about the, I said it as respectfully as I could, that you can't say this about the Aruch HaShulchan, that the Aruch HaShulchan, you shouldn't start, use the Aruch HaShulchan as your go-to work. Subsequent to writing this in the, around 2010, you have a new edition that came out of the Aruch HaShulchan, published in Israel. And it's the Aruch HaShulchan, but in the bottom, you have the notes there. So it's the Aruch HaShulchan on top, and the bottom, it says, Piskei Mishnah Berurah. So every time the Aruch HaShulchan says something, the Mishnah Berurah disagrees, you have the correction, as it were, of the Mishnah Berurah. What this is saying is to people that, yes, you can all buy the Aruch HaShulchan as a work of Torah to learn, but in terms of practical halacha, what it means is that the Aruch HaShulchan is not to be relied on, because we're telling you every time that the Mishnah Berurah disagrees. Rav Dov Lior, who we saw him earlier, he has a response in Tshuva in the Sefer, he wrote a blistering attack about how this is an unbelievable chutzpah, that the Aruch HaShulchan is no longer able to exist as an independent Sefer without pointing out that you can't rely on it. And here the Mishnah Berurah says this. And it is a really degrading of the Aruch HaShulchan to say that he only now can stand if you point out where you shouldn't follow him. So, You can, if anyone's interested, you can see Rav Lior, his attack on that edition. But it is true. And then I say that it's known that all the Gedolim of Lita relied very much on the Aruch HaShulchan, and there are many Gedolim who thought that the koach, the power of the Aruch HaShulchan, Gadol Yoser Mi'Mishnah Berurah, that is greater, that we rely on him, oh, if there's a machokas between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, we go like the Aruch HaShulchan. Now, then I go on, I say, I don't think you can say that one is greater than another. I mean, who are we to say, who's even a posek today to say that one is greater? But it's not about greater, it's just, but they're saying, I mean, they said it, it's not for us to say it, that if there's a machokas, you rely on the Aruch HaShulchan. It doesn't even mean he's greater. It just means for whatever reason that his psukim are to be accepted. The Rugged Shaver was definitely greater in learning than the Mishnah Berurah. There's no question about it. But we don't rely on the Rugged Shaver's halachot. Greatness is, that's not the only thing. There have been great rabbis who just, but they're not accepted in terms of the final halachic ruling. It's never been just because you have the greatest mind. Rav Chaim Ozer was never, no one felt Rav Chaim Ozer was greater in learning than the Rugged Shaver, but everyone accepted Rav Chaim Ozer over the Rugged Shaver. That's halacha is not only about who's the greatest genius. There's all sorts of, and as Rav Moshe Feinstein once said, that we have a lot of tsaras from Iluyim. The Iluyim, geniuses often cause a lot of troubles because they're so great that they come up with all sorts of unusual things. And so you gotta, Rav Moshe says that we have tsaras sometimes from Iluyim. But I said to him, it's not for us to judge who's greater. I just want to say that, the words of the Aruch HaShulchan are Divrei Elohim Chayim. They're Torah. And they were accepted among all Gedol Yisrael. And Chas V'Shalom to lessen his kavod. And I said that you mentioned the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish rejected in Aruch HaShulchan. But I say that the truth is, as I heard from Talmid Chachamim who are Bucky, who are learning in this, that on almost every page of the Chazon Ish's works, he rejects the Mishnah Berurah too. So the fact that the Aruch HaShulchan is rejected by the Chazon Ish in one place, so what? He rejects doesn't say that you can't rely on the Aruch HaShulchan. He rejects the Mishnah Berurah also. So let us begin with his answer. And then we won't be able to finish it, but we'll at least start on the answer, and then we'll pick up the first paragraph. He answers, Vaya'an Yitzhak. Isaac, his name is Yitzhak, answers. Okay, the first question. Can you take a heter from this posek and from that posek? I mean, the whole issue is so interesting because what's the role of the community rabbi here? If let's say I go on, people have spoken about this. I go to Rabbi Google. What's the issue here? So I go to Rabbi Google and I see there's an article by Big Tamach Chacham and he presents the different shitot. And then he presents what he thinks is the proper approach. I have no connection to this rabbi. There's plenty of big Talmidei Chachamim writing on online. What do I need to then go ask the local rabbi? Can I open a can on Shabbos to drink the soda? What do I need to ask the rabbi for? I already know the different shitas. So okay, so then maybe it's Machlokas or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Ramosha, let's say. So either can I decide myself? And if I go to the rabbi, so then the rabbi, how does... Because the rabbi then gets to decide who we go by. I mean, we're not talking about a posek ador here. It's you're going to the local rabbi. Do I need to call Rabbi Willig or Schechter or somebody to ask him? Now, how does this work in the real world? Okay. He says, you ask, can you take a heter from this posek and a heter from another posek? In different matters. Basically, can you look? I won't say can you look for a heterim because he's going to deal with that as well. Before we get to that issue, can you shop for heterim, as they say? He's just dealing with the more fundamental question. Is there any problem in taking a heter, let's say, in Hilchos Sukkah from the Mishnah Berurah, but you don't follow the Mishnah Berurah in every case? Which, I repeat, we all do, because every one of us here basically relies on heterim of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Size of the Mechitza, that you can go down the list. But we don't follow his chumras, unless you're a Talmud Muthak, because the Jewish community as a whole doesn't follow. And Rav Moshe Feinstein himself says, I know they're not going to follow what I say about time clocks, etc. So he holds, what he explains in the next paragraph is that there's no issue really, as long as there's no contradiction. It's not a problem if you could take a heter, let's say, from the Mishnah Berurah in one area, the Chayyam in another area. You're not obligated to follow one sefer completely. Now, if you read what he writes here, it's sort of, he sort of moves into really speaking about what a Talmud Chacham does, because he develops the idea that if you're a Talmud Chacham, how you come up when you're learning, that's what you follow. And that's fine. You don't need to follow every, but my question really wasn't about Talmud Chacham. It was about one of the masses, which was, he answered properly in the first paragraph. But the principle, I think, is probably still the same. He says that just because you take from one sefer, you're not bound to take everything from that sefer. And he continues, so then the question, it has been solved. Can you take, like, from this posseg in Hilchos Shabbos, another posseg in Hilchos Sukkah? And he says, there's no problem with that, either L'chumra. But then he says, and this is why he doesn't really answer my question. What are we talking about here? If someone goes mitalech misharim b'darchei elimud, masos ritzon yitzro. If someone is a serious person in their learning, they're not trying to make a game of this. They're trying to really follow what the halacha should be. And you come to a maskana. So if I'm a learned person and I'm studying it, then in this case, I come to the conclusion that the Mishnah Berurah is right. I'm not the Posek Adorah, but I'm a Talmud Chacham. I conclude that Mishnah Berurah is right. In another case, it looks like the Chayyadah makes more sense. He says there's no problem. In that case, you could, as long as you're not looking for Heter, but that's what you actually authentically conclude, fine, you could take the Mishnah Berurah here, you could take the Chayyadah, and they're not bound to follow one authority all the time. Okay, that makes sense. But my question was really wasn't dealing about the Talmudic scholar. I wanted to know about the average person. You don't know what to do. You go online and you see the different shitas, where Shlomo Zalman is Meiko and Ravad Yosef is Machmir. Can you simply make your own decision here what you're going to do? Or do you then, are you back to square one where I then have to go to the rabbi? Every single time there's a question, you got to go to your local rabbi. And your local rabbi, what's your local rabbi going to do? He's going to look at the same sources. And what's he? So is there any room for autonomy? And I don't have the answer for this. Is there any room for autonomy from the typical balabas? You know, can the balabas simply know that Rav Avadya says this and Rav Shlomo Zalman says this and they're both reliable rabbis, therefore it's okay to follow whichever one you want? Or in all such cases, do you need to follow to approach a rabbi? And the rabbi's not poskening. The rabbi is just going to tell you either what he was told by his rabbi or what he thinks the general minhag is. But what does that mean, the general minhag? I had a friend, he actually wrote this. He's a rabbi, and it's online, or at least it used to be online. He has a whole thing on his website, the shul's website, about gelatin. And he writes that, you know, in America, the practice is not to eat gelatin. That's the post-scheme in America. Therefore, he goes, but in Eretz Yisrael, if you move, go to Eretz Yisrael, you know, Ravad Yosef and the others have held the gelatins permissible. So then you can eat it there. My question was, what happens when you're on the airplane? You know, when you're halfway there, you can. But I mean, is that what it comes down to? That we're just going to follow what's the general practices? Or is there any, and like I said, the real issue, which please email me, let me know what you think, what you've heard. I mean, does the individual, is there any autonomy? Can you simply look and say, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was a great Torah scholar. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who's greater than him? If he says that this is permissible on Shabbos, okay, you can do it. And then you're going to say, well, wait a second, Ravad Yosef says it's usher. Can a simple person say, well, you know what? Rav Shlomo Zalman's big enough for me. And he doesn't really answer that question. What he only answers is about someone who's able to learn, who's convinced. And we're going to see next week, he explains also this idea of shopping for heterim or shopping for chumros. There's plenty of people who always shop for chumros. That's going to be wrong. But I don't have the answer to this question. I was told when I was in high school by Rabbi Parnas, a Rebbe then, he didn't think there was a problem. You know, if you have a dispute between Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe Feinstein, he thought it was okay to just decide that you're going to go with Rav Shlomo Zalman. But I don't know if you remember saying that, or he was quite young then. I don't know. I don't know what my sense is that when you deal with the really great ones, there seems to be autonomy. There's less autonomy when you deal with people. You have a great one, Rav Shlomo Zalman, and someone on a lesser level. But I could be wrong on this. And it's... I know when you ask Rav Schachter sometimes these questions, he doesn't really answer. He says, Rav Avadya's mater, Rav Shlomo Zalman's machmir, but Rav Avadya's meiko. But he doesn't really tell you what he thinks. He just says, you know, there's a machmir. I guess that's an answer too. He's giving it into your hands to do with it you wish. But the question remains, and we're going to pick up. Oh, so we're going to pick up. We got to continue with this, and then we got to get to the Aruch HaShulchan when he tells me that I'm wrong. That Dafka, he didn't hear this from Hungarians. Wait till you heard in the name of that you don't rely on the Aruch HaShulchan. And then we're going to move on to Ramanasha Klein. Very relevant, because the question I asked him is about voting. When we decide to vote, when we vote for candidates, whoever it is, we have an election coming up in a couple of weeks. Does halacha have anything to say on this? The Jewish values? Does it matter? Is there such a thing that halacha says you have to vote for this or that? Because let's say this one is going to allow abortion and this one's not. But before we even get to that, we'll see Rav Menashe Klein thinks that everything I was quoting from the internet's wrong, because can you even do halacha in English? Can you write it in English? The whole idea of Torah in the vernacular, we have seen such a revolution in our time. We had Torah in English, the Encino, we had other things, but now we have Mamash Svarim of the highest level, Svarim of Rabbi Bleich and others, where you don't have anything like them in Hebrew. That, in other words, they're not just summaries, they're actual independent works, which anyone interested in halacha, if he doesn't read English, or she, they're really missing out. This is a completely new phenomenon, which we haven't had really since medieval times, where the Rambam wrote in Arabic. But remember, when the Rambam was writing in Arabic and others, they were writing in Hebrew letters. So we'll see what Menashe Klein has to say about that. Okay, let me take some questions here and comments. We're moving into interesting areas. Susanna says, the court has a Gaia Meta Ganvaihi. Yes, it does. Everyone has a meteg on in Breishis, on the Vayhi. But if you look at elsewhere, just look at a concordance. There's plenty of other examples where the word Vayhi appears without the meteg, then you will see that it there's no question it's Vayhi. That it's, but the issue is only here. It has the meteg on it because it has the what they call the makef, that hyphen thing. At the master, the hyphen thing's important. For example, we use it many times with kamatz katan. So, for instance, kol, the word kol that we pronounce kol, it has a kamatz under it because we're pronouncing it like kamatz katan. If it doesn't have the makef, it has the cholam. There's only one place, or two places, where you have the word, including one in Tehillim, where kaf vav lamed then. Kalatz motai tomarno. That's the pasuk, right? That's always pronounced wrong. It's not kol, it's kal. If you pronounce it like a Sephardi, it's kal. Ashkenaz, but if you pronounce kol, like we all do, kol, whatever, then every time there's a kamatz katan, you should pronounce it the same way. So it's chokhma, shomra, oznaim. Ellen says, the Sephardim didn't follow the local minhag when they moved to Greece. The Sephardim didn't follow, that's right, Ellen, you came with us to Greece, I believe. If not, you came with us everywhere else. The Sephardim didn't follow the minhag when they came to Greece. They didn't follow the minhag when they came to Morocco. They didn't follow the minhag anywhere they went. The Sephardim went, so you could, maybe Chacham Avad, you would say they went as a group. They did go as a group, but they what happened was the locals in Morocco and also the locals in Greece said that you Sephardim, you're coming into our land, you have to follow our minhagim. And the Sephardim said, forget that. The Sephardim didn't keep God kosher when they came to Morocco. We saw that. The local Moroccans did. And that created that huge dispute. You're absolutely right. The Sephardim did not follow. So the Moroccans today are doing the exact same thing that their foreparents did. Kalman says, did Rav Avadya ever state his opinion of public shiur in his writings? They're in his writings all the time. He's always saying this, but he never really explained, at least I haven't seen, why the Moroccans are really different than the Ashkenazi, which his son did. And he's never explained why the Yemenites should be counted as Sephardim. They accepted the Shulchan Aruch, at least a good portion of them. So I guess that makes them Sephardim, but I get that's what the son says. But the Yemenites don't consider themselves Sephardim. The fact that they accepted the Shulchan Aruch, I mean, you have, just because you accept a psak of someone doesn't mean that all of a sudden you're a Sephardi. Now you're bound by the Eretz Yisrael. They always kept their own minhagim. Yes, Baruch says rupture, reconstruction, the Yedot HaMizrach version. You can do that. There's a guy named Joseph Ringel, and he has an article about Rabbi Zinni's critique of Chacham Avad Yosef, which is basically, he's trying to do that. But you could do that for every single one of the Sephardic lands. And I think Rabbi Kelman's actually going to do that a bit. He's trying to organize a group of speakers speaking about Sephardic halacha and minhag, and that'll have to be one of the issues. Well, do the Sephardic halacha and minhag really continue, or have they been normatized by Chacham Avad Yosef? So Rabbi Kelman, maybe at the end, you'll announce. I know it's in the planning.
No, next Monday. We're starting next Monday, even though Rabbi Chweck is going to give a three-part series on Sephardic halacha. The part that isn't finalized yet, we want to continue that with, you know, as we discuss culture halacha from other communities around the world. But next Monday morning, 11 a.m., Rabbi Chweck will be giving a beginning of a three-part series on Sephardic halacha. But back to you. We'll talk about that later.
Okay, someone privately emails me. There's one of the old Chazan Balakore from the Hirschminyan in Washington Heights. There's tapes of him on Dartmouth. I signed up, but they haven't approved me yet. He says the Shva in Vayichi is pronounced Vayichi. And also in the Mordechai Berurah Tanakh. I don't know what that means, the Mordechai Berurah Tanakh. The Mordechai Berurah Tanakh, you can't hear, you can only see. The fact that there's a Gaia there is irrelevant. Everyone knows there's a Gaia there. But the Minchat Shai and others tell us that even though the Gaia is there, you still pronounce it as a Shva Nach. But that, if you're saying that that maybe is the Frankfurt tradition to also pronounce it as Vayichi, Vayihi. By the way, it's the same thing as Vayichi. It would be the same issue. I don't know. But look at all the tikkunim. I have yet to find a tikkun that has it. But I'd like to see. I looked in Heidenheim. Heidenheim, I thought, because he sometimes has interesting things. Heidenheim does not comment on whether that's Shvana or Shvanach. Howard says, individual Moroccans who came before a group adopted a position of Shulchan Aruch, would they need a Tarat Neder to go back to customs of Moroccan Jews? According to Chacham Avad Yosef, they're not allowed to go back to the practices of Moroccan Jews. So it's not, a Tarat Nederim doesn't help. They're not allowed to. Because then if Moroccans came as a group and were a complete community, that's like a B'di'avad situation. He does not hold you allowed to. Do any of Rav Avadia's children take positions contrary to Rav Avadia? Excellent question, and the answer is yes. I'm going to show you who it is, who I never had an opportunity this is an interesting story here. Let me show you on the screen here. Here. It was a sad story. You can see here Rav Yaakov Yosef. He predeceased his father, Rav Avad Yosef. They said he was the greatest Talmud Chacham of all the children. But I'm curious. You can read up later. He broke with his father. He became very right-wing politically. He came out publicly against his father's positions. He aligned himself with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. You know what that means. Chacham Avad Yosef and Mordechai Eliyahu did not get along. He aligned himself with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and he published a sefer. Well, he died in 40. He used to give shirim every night, but they only published one of his sefarim in which he criticizes his father's rulings. I have the sefer. I don't have it here. I have it in Scranton. By the end of his life, Rav Yaakov Yosef was following the old Iraqi approach, Ben Ishchai and other things. He had a break with his father. In the last years of his life, they had a reconciliation of sorts. And as I said, he became sick and he predeceased his father. But he's the only one that didn't follow the family. It's a family business in that they have all the Sfarim. Rav David Yosef has all these volumes called Halacha Berurah, which are not as popular as Yalkut Yosef, but are full of learning. And he disagrees a few times with his brother, like what Bracha make on Bamba and others, but it's the same basic approach. Rav Avram Yosef, who I quoted, has never published any Sfarim. I don't know why. Thanksgiving 2019 was also Rosh Chodesh. Kalman says, the Chafetz Chaim's son, Reb Leib, in his biography, writes that he wrote parts of the Mishnah Berurah and provides an example of a contradiction in which he resolves by saying he passed in one way where his father's passed in the opposite way. Correct. the son of the Chofetz Chaim explains that the reason there's contradictions, and he gives an example, is because he helped his father write it. And in one section, he wrote it, it's Hilchos Shabbos, actually, and another section, his father wrote it. That explains the contradiction. Howard says, can we rely on Chai Adam or any other sefer in an instance where every other posek argues on a specific issue? Rabbi Rasabi says yes. Rabbi Rasabi says that these are they're reliable posek, so it doesn't matter. But he says you'll learn that this is not the general practice. So if it's not the general practice, and then you learn that, can you still continue relying on it? His language is, you can ask the same question. Can you rely on Ramosha Feinstein? What if everyone disagrees? I think we assume you can. What he says is, the exact language here I want to show you, where is it? I don't know where it is now. This is what he says. He says you're allowed to do like any of these books, as long as you don't know that. He says that the minhag's not like them. So I take back what I said. He says that if you can take any book you want, but then if the general practice is not like them, you shouldn't do it. But until then, it's fine. You can rely on it. But once you learn that the general practice is not, but I don't know. It's a difficult thing because where do you take this? So. What does that mean? The general, when does the general practice? Do we say today that the general practice is not like Ramosha Feinstein's, therefore his heter that you got from him or that he gave is no longer reliable? I think everyone agreed that there comes a point where that is the case. I mean, eventually there comes a point where even the greatest rabbis, their views are no longer binding anymore, or are no longer reliable for us. We can't be relying on them. But that's what they wanted to say about Ramosha and the schnapps. That we can't rely on his opinion anymore, that you need hashgacha on it. I don't know when, it was pretty quick to say it. But look, we can't rely on, just because a posek said something 100 years ago, doesn't mean that if everyone, otherwise we'd all be lighting Ashkenazim, I should say. Sephardim have a different approach. But the Aruch HaShulchan, he said that you could turn on lights on Yom Tov. And in his day, plenty of people did. It's very hard to make the case today. That just because the Aruch HaShulchan says it, we can do it. Because everyone has rejected it, and he didn't really understand how electricity works. Baruch says, the learned Baruch, among Litvish Rabbanim, the Aruch HaShulchan was favored. Rosh Yeshiva preferred Mishnah Berurah. Rav Aaron Cutler in particular tried to spread the idea that Mishnah Berurah is the code to follow. He would carry it around with him. Yes, and there's famous photographs of him carrying it. But Rabbanim, Baruch tells us, because Rabbanim, they're Shtut Rabbanim, they would follow the Aruch HaShulchan. And the two works are quite different. Obviously, as he points out, the Aruch HaShulchan is more conceptual. The Mishnah Berurah, he says it, Mishnah Berurah. No, Mishnah Berurah. Good question. Why shouldn't it be Mishnah Berurah? Maybe it should be, but we all say Mishnah Berurah. That's not a conceptual work, although we have in the Be'er Halacha, perhaps, but in the Mishnah Berurah, it's more of just a looking at the different, collecting the different sources, different things, more chumras, etc., etc. Or as some have said, one does not want a posek who's a tzaddik gomer, he'll be too machmir. And a posek was always a communal rav, not the Rosh Hashiva, who did not deal with the average person. On Shabbos, in what I was reading, one of the gedolim, I have a collection, hasn't been published yet. I don't know if it ever will, but one of the great rabbanim has put together a collection of stories. Now, most of the stories are complete bubble mises, and they're not true. He even talks about how David Ben-Gurion came with his wife Paula to Berlin, and Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg had a whole conversation with them, and then Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg married them in Berlin. It's such nonsense. I just, right after Yontif, I looked online, David Ben-Gurion married Paula, the name Paula should say something, in New York City in 1917. So, I mean, but he has a number of things that he heard personally, and one of them says exactly what Rabbi Kelman said, that the reason they didn't hold by the Chafetz Chaim was because he was the Tzaddik Ador, and the Tzaddik Ador can't be the Posek Ador. Well, Ramosha Shmuel, he says, was Rosh Hashiva, he would probably consider similar to the Aruch HaShulchan, since he was always involved in Pasuk Halacha. And Ramosha is known as the Posek. Even though he wanted to be the Rosh Hashiva, he's known as the Posek, and he was a Shtut Rav in Russia. Today we have Rosh Hashiva who've never been rabbis, and have never dealt with, first of all, some never dealt with Pasuk Halacha to begin with, We have Rosh Yeshiva who don't know about Pesach. That's not what they focus on. But some have never, literally, Rosh Yeshiva have never dealt with Balabatim, average type of regular people. So they're in a yeshiva world environment their entire life. And obviously that's going to be a different type of rabbi. Yeah. Yes, Howard says, the excellent biography in the Aruch HaShulchan by Eitam Henkin, Hashem Yikom Damo, he deals with his grandfather's approach to the Aruch HaShulchan. And it's the only academic work on the Aruch HaShulchan. That is correct. He even has an article in which he deals with the Rabbi Lior's piece that I mentioned. Howard says, if you're Talmud or Moshe Feinstein, you need to follow his Pesachim. I think the general assumption is if you're a close Talmud, you do. Chumra and Lakua. But we know that people who were not such close Talmidim, the assumptions, at least my impression, has always been that you don't need to. But yes, close Talmidim, you're supposed to follow everything. Unless the Rav tells you, you know, this is just my personal chumra. Close Talmidim, you're supposed to, when I say close, I mean ones who would ask all their shilas. Most of us are not like that. We go out there and we're asking whatever rabbi comes to town. You have a question, you ask him. We have in my town. What's the whole idea in my town? Like every other month, Shachter will come and ask the rabbi. What's the point of that? He comes in and it just asks questions. That's it. So here, so now all of a sudden I ask a question. What do I do on Pesach? Does that mean now that every single Shaila I need to ask them? No one thinks that. But yet you bring these rabbis into town and all of a sudden it's you ask the posik. No one assumes. But yes, if you're a Talmud Mufak, you're supposed to follow everything, Chumrah and Kula. But I can tell you from personal experience, including I knew Rabbi Felder, who was as close to Talmud Mufak Vermosha as anyone was, Rav Aaron Felder, that even Talmud Mufak, there will be a time, because first of all, it depends, I think we need to distinguish Talmud Mufak. Someone like Rabbi Felder, he is a great enough of a Talmud that he could come up with some of his own ideas. Rav Schechter is a Talmud Mufak of Soloveitchik, but he disagrees with him. But I think that for one who's not at the level to be a lamdin, at the level to be a posek, I do think if you study in someone's yeshiva for many years and you're a Talmud Mufak, I think in that case you would have to follow, I think, Chumra and Lakua. But again, I already said that Rav Moshe himself said that they're not going to follow me on time clocks. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that you're supposed to make ha'etz on the chocolate. And he himself said, though, but I know no one's going to listen to me. And even his own Talmudim don't listen to him because Rav Shlomo Zalman said, you know, I realize this is against the minhag. But I think in general, yes, you should follow. And Shmuley says that Rav Moshe's son, David, occasionally disagrees with his father. But okay, that's not the case I'm talking about, though. Rav David's a posek in and of himself. He's allowed to disagree with his father. But if you're just a regular sort of Talmud, I do think you have to follow everything. That's the tradition. Why are Persians considered to be Sephardim? Yes, why are Iraqis considered to be Sephardim? They're the Edot Mizrach and the Sephardim. Sephardim means Spanish, have all been put together. Rav Shimon Ba'adani is on Moetzes HaShas, so there must be Sephardim then. He is a Yemenite. They put him on it. And finally, did Rav Ephraim Greenblatt ever disagree with Rav Moshe? Well, we had the case where it's clear to me, at least, he disagreed with Rav Moshe when he said that for Shabbos you can invite people for Yom Tov, for the Seder, and other times he said you can invite them. And he went with Rav Shlomo Zalman in that case, and he knew what his Rebbe held.
Even if they'll drive.
I don't know if that's a matter of Ephraim Greenblatt disagreeing with Rav Moshe or simply saying I'm not going to follow Rav Moshe. I never asked him why he didn't follow. He might have said that in this matter, I think the logic of Rav Shlomo Zalman is better. I don't know. But Rav Ephraim Greenblatt is more of a Talmud Mufak even than Rabbi Felder. There's more tshuvot to Rabbi Greenblatt than anyone in Igros Moshe. But he's a Bar Hachi, as they say. So I don't know why in that case he didn't. But he did in that case, at least. I don't know if there's any other cases where he disagreed with Rav Moshe. Okay, thank you all very much. If Rabbi Kelman wants to have some final words, we got good stuff. Stay tuned for next week, God willing. Good stuff coming.
Thank you. No, just this week, of course, Benny Gesundheit tomorrow, Sefer Tehillim, continuing our series. Wednesday, I mentioned Mark Trencher. I sent that out earlier today, who's done the surveys on the modern Orthodox world, 6 surveys, very fascinating information. He'll be speaking Wednesday morning at 11 a.m. Thursday evening, we're going to restart with a new section of the Torah, beginning to our rotating Parsha share. I'm going to kick it off on Thursday night. That's, please God, 8:30. And as I mentioned, on Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag is starting from Lord Balfour to from Cyrus to Lord Balfour. The books on Tanakh and by Cheney, and we'll be doing that beginning on Sunday. And Monday, as I mentioned, Rabbi Chweck will be beginning a 3-part series on Sephardic Halakha. We have a few more. We're going to be doing archaeology and Halakha, a whole bunch of things. We'll send out a broader email later. But basically, next week, every day, we'll be having classes at 11 a.m. usual, and a couple evenings. So stay forward. Lots of Torah to learn, Baruch Hashem. And we look forward to seeing you in good health. And thank you very much. Okay, everybody,
good night, everyone.
Good night, and be well. Thank you.